So my talk is called The Final Frontier of Reverse Engineering. Reverse engineering traditionally is done on... Also, I've done some reverse engineering on like the iPhone and the PS3, but those are devices made by men. The final frontier is a device made by God, evolution, or whatever, the human brain. We have an incredibly powerful computer in our heads that we know so little about. In fact, we all walk around with one, and we know so little about it. So I'll talk about it a bit, pose a couple experiments, and... Who am I? My name is George Hotz. I've done... I'm a contract reverse engineer. Software stuff, I've done... How many of you have jailbroken your iPhones? Use any of the softwares that end in RAIN? Lime RAIN, Black RAIN, Purple RAIN? I'm the guy who wrote those. I did the PS3 jailbreaks, then got sued by Sony for them. When I was 15, I first read Eliza Yudowski, and this is I'm probably pronouncing his name wrong, but he first told me about ideas like, you know, singularity, right? Our brain is a device like any other. If we can build brains, and these brains can build better brains, and those brains can build better brains. For example, there's a law called Moore's Law in computing, which says that computing power doubles every 18 months. Well, basically that says that the human race as a collective doubles the power of computing every 18 months. So if we can build a computer with the same power as the human race, then it can double its own power every 18 months, but next time it only takes 9 months, and the time after that 4.5, and in 36 months you get singularity. Which is, well, certainly beyond what I can comprehend with my human mind. One, you are Turing computable. Now, this is weird to think about. Where are my notes? How come my notes didn't show up here? Whatever. It means that Turing computable means that you can be simulated on a Turing machine. You have a chunk of hardware in your head, and your hardware runs your brain software pretty well. But there's no reason that it can't run on silicon instead of on biology. It's possible that you're already running on an Apple IIe computer. You wouldn't really know it, because there's no way from you inside the system to say things about what's a level up and what's outside the system. And you are Turing computable. When this really sinks in, it's psychologically unsatisfying to a lot of people. You know, you feel strong emotions, you feel happiness and sadness, and it sort of trivializes things to think, well, this is really just neurotransmitters in your head and signals being sent to the right places. But hopefully in this talk, I'll explain to you why it's awesome that you are Turing computable and tell you that the future is going to be crazier than a lot of people are predicting. Once we start to mess with, like, throughout history, throughout the history of humanity, human brains have been pretty much at the same level. But engineering has been increasing, and we've almost gotten to the point where engineering matches the human brain. The human brain has about 38 petaflops of computing power, 3.5 petabytes of storage, and uses about 20 watts of power, which 20 watts is less than my laptop is drawing right now to show you this presentation. For comparison, my laptop is a couple gigaflops, orders of magnitude off from what your brain can do. Forget server farms, I want brains in my data center. In 2011, we crossed a very critical threshold. The amount of silicon compute power in the world finally caught up with one single human brain. So we're getting there. And if Moore's Law continues, by 2020, 2030, we'll have enough computing power in one computer to simulate a human brain. I want a metacortex. So you have some cortices in your brain. You have a visual cortex, which processes vision, an auditory cortex, which processes sound, a somatosensory cortex, which processes smell. But imagine another cortex. And the input to this cortex is the internet. Now, you know, it sounds, oh, there's a cortex which has an internet sense, but you already sort of have one of these metacortices. And it's right in probably everyone's pockets, your phone. It doesn't really matter how things are linked. Like, just because things are linked by neurons or things happen to be linked through a motor cortex, through muscles, through my fingers, and then back through my vision system, brains don't really care. Neural circuitry is so flexible that it doesn't matter. You know, when you've been spending a lot of time with somebody, you know how you sort of feel like you can really feel what they're feeling. You're linked to them. The only question is the bandwidth of this link, right? So you have a your left brain and a right brain, and they're linked by this corpus callosum thing. And the corpus callosum is pretty high bandwidth. There's a lot of connections going from the left brain to the right brain. There have been studies where they take out people's corpus callosums, and the left brain and the right brain function independently, and they, you know, like a guy tries to, like, raise his right hand, and his left hand comes up to grab it. The two brains are literally fighting each other. But what I'm getting to here is that it doesn't really matter. Neural circuitry's... all it does is needs connections and needs bandwidth. It doesn't matter how these connections exactly come into the brain. It doesn't matter where this bandwidth comes from, right? Like, so right now I'm talking to you, that's a pretty one-way communications channel. But when you get a two-way communications channel, you're, you know, it's it becomes sort of one brain. And I'll get into this a little bit more later. So my internet sense is tingling. My cell phone's vibrating. Like, literally, it becomes an extension of you. And I don't say this in, like, the, you know, Ray Kurzweil, the singularity's already here way, but I say this in the, it's not so far off. It's not such a far-fetched idea. So let's talk a little bit about bandwidth, right? Upstream bandwidth. I'm talking about bandwidth from you to the outside world, right? Upstream bandwidth, I can type 100 words a minute, right? 100 words a minute, I do a little bit of math up there. It's about 42 bits per second. So maybe you can talk a bit faster. It's 200 bits per second. 200 bits per second is nothing. If you guys have cable modems at home, your upstream bandwidth is on the order of 5 megabits. It's 5 million bits per second instead of 200 bits per second. You know, there's a guy at Google, Jeff Dean. He's the guy who wrote Big Table and a lot of the key Google technologies, and we make jokes about him. And, you know, Jeff Dean needed to upgrade his keyboard to USB 2.0 for the extra megabits. Right, USB 1.0 is 12 megabits. You know, Jeff Dean, he typed so fast that he needed the 480 that USB 2 provides. So let's look at it the other way. Downstream bandwidth. You can read at about 1,000 words per minute. And what's funny is the paradigm of reading hasn't changed since the advent of books. Reading is still one of the most efficient ways to get information into the brain. I mean, you could say, okay, like, or maybe TV shows. I mean, TV shows clearly have more bandwidth. I make a joke up there about Jersey Shore. But TV shows don't... I mean, for example, when you watch, like, something on Nova, you can read the transcript in a lot less time than you can watch the TV show, so it's questionable which way you're actually getting more information into the brain. And this is even a very generous number, 425 bits per second, because they've done studies, and the studies show that even people with amazing long-term memories can only remember, on average, 2 bits per second. 2 bits per second is nothing. You are a supercomputer with dial-up internet. Your brain has almost the same amount of compute power as every silicon computer in the world combined, yet the bandwidth in and out of it is on the order of 400/200 bits. Now, if you have like even a DSL line, even your 3G phone, 1.5 megabits, 1.5 million up, and 768,000 down. Orders of magnitude off. So, what if we could get more information in and out of the brain? So there's this whole idea of brain-computer interfaces, right? You know, I'm going to put some electrodes on my head and I'm going to send information in and out of the brain. In 2006, I was in the... I did science fairs in high school. And one of the projects I made was an electroencephalograph, EEG, put it on my head, and I wrote Pong. And I called it Mind Pong, and you could play Pong with your mind, right? You could, if you thought light thoughts, you could move the slider up. If you thought heavy thoughts, you could move the slider down. And eventually, you didn't even really have to think light thoughts or heavy thoughts. You could just think, move the slider up, move the slider down. And you could get pretty good at this, but it was all pretty low bandwidth, right? It's one slider. It's one Atari paddle, and you can still be better with the Atari paddle than you could ever be with the brain-computer interfaces. But we already have brain-computer interfaces. Maybe not in the futuristic high-tech, you know, I think of a banana and a banana appears on the screen sort of game, but brain-computer interfaces are already all around us. Monitors get information into your brain. Keyboards get information out of your brain. What I'm saying is it really doesn't matter, like, so what that I'm going through a bit of motor cortex, a bit of muscle, a bit of visual cortex. Like, it's the same idea. The only important question is bandwidth. And you bought the OCZ Neural Impulse Activator. This came out in 2008. You could buy it as a toy from OCZ. It was an electroencephalograph, and you could play sort of games. Sort of fun, but yeah, really low bandwidth. So what raises the bandwidth? Well, good visualizations raise the bandwidth. Think about a large data set, and think about looking at a large data set in like an Excel spreadsheet. And it's hard for you to visualize. Like, you can go down and you can read these numbers, but you're not really getting that much information, important information, into your brain. So I'll take an aside here, and I mentioned on an earlier slide, Kolmogorov complexity is basically how much information does some data contain, right? Like, a string of A's, we would all agree, has less information than a sentence like the quick brown fox jumps over the dirty dog or whatever it is. So how much information, like, so another way to express Kolmogorov complexity is with a perfect compression algorithm. If something compresses down, it's less complex than something that doesn't compress down. So how much important information are we getting into the brain? The spreadsheet, you're probably not getting very much. Even if you memorized all those numbers, you're not getting, you know, like, high level information, so good visualizations. There's a cool thing in psychology, I guess, called impossible colors. And you can, by showing people like blue in one eye and yellow in the other eye, you can get them to visualize, to see a color they've never seen before. And this is a little bit more bandwidth than you normally get, right? There's normally bandwidth in the visual spectrum. You get a little bit more if you could see these impossible colors. And that just alludes to this idea that if you can put arbitrary things into the brain, you can get like crazy amounts of information in. I don't really think it's limited. I don't really think, it's certainly, we're nowhere near what the limits are. The amount of information that, you know, the scene from The Matrix, Neo sits in the chair and he shakes for a little bit and he's like, I know Kung Fu, right? Think about how much information just went into his brain. It's a very high bandwidth link. All comes down to bandwidth. Another way to raise the bandwidth is shoving wires into the brain, and people have tried this, or optogenetics. You could put a proton pump in that's activated by light into neurons, and you could shine light at neurons and get them to trigger. But nobody really knows how to get a high bandwidth connection. It's all really low bandwidth stuff. It's like, you know, is the leg moving? Is the leg not moving? Well, I mean, if you want to know that, that's a stupid way to sense it. Put a potentiometer on the leg, you'll know exactly where the leg is, too. So we don't really have, by shoving wires in the brain, we haven't, to date, been able to raise the bandwidth. You know, you can talk twice as fast. Raises the bandwidth, too. Consciousness is strange. Let me actually look at one of my notes. It sort of has to be an illusion when you think about it. Like, what really is what makes up consciousness? I remember in sixth grade, really young in middle school, I used to have these thoughts like, how did I become me? And I don't really know how to explain that better, but it's like, you feel this sort of sense of self, and it's, but all you are is, here's a saying, a physicist is an atom's way of thinking about atoms. All you are is atoms moving around. Yet you give rise to this crazy illusion called consciousness, and it's strange. Like, so here's a cool experiment. Say you walked out into a swamp and you got struck by lightning. You're dead lying in the swamp, but simultaneously, when you get struck by that lightning, the atoms next to you rearrange into an exact copy of you. And that copy of you walks out of the swamp and goes on to live your life. What happened? Is that you? Or if you guys saw the Prestige, I'm not going to give away any of the plot, but you know what I'm talking about. It's a weird sort of like, and we think, oh, we're humans and we have this thing called consciousness, and you know, there's religious explanations for it. There tries to be scientific explanations for it. People like Roger Penrose try really hard to justify that it's not computable out of a, you know, psychological satisfaction sort of thing. I think I am. I think therefore I am. All you can really do is think you are. And this idea that the world is real, that doesn't necessarily have to be true. Our compute substrate could actually be somewhere else, and we're just jacked into this virtual world, but, you know, I'm not going to play out matrixy plots. But I will ask the next question. How does it feel to be a web server? Right? You know, it's to say, oh, well, we're conscious and web servers aren't. Well, how do you know? We've never really been a web server before. And the questions of whether machines can be conscious is, I mean, yes. What is consciousness? It's just the fact that you say, I am conscious. And the idea of ego death, you know, where does me stop, right? I have this idea that, you know, my arm is a part of me and my head's a part of me, but it's really an illusion. And there's an experiment that shows this where, you know, people use a hammer every day. You know, they're holding the hammer in their hand. And the hammer becomes an extension of them so much that they misinterpret stimuli on their forearm. They think the end of their hand is now at the end of the hammer. So when you touch here, they think they're being touched here if they have a hammer on their hand. It becomes really, really a part of you, or people with prosthetic limbs, I'm sure, feel the same way. Then here's another question. Where does my brain stop? Right? Okay, so we say it's in my head, but you know what I was talking about, bandwidth and communication, and maybe this is sort of part of my brain now. I mean, it is, and I rely on it. There's an XKCD where he's got Wikipedia goes down, and I just lost 50 IQ points. Well, it's sort of true. And then especially with the rise of social networks and the amount of bandwidth flying through the world. I mean, this is a metric that you can see has been rising throughout time. It's where does my brain stop? Corporations are people, right? What's a corporation? Well, it's a bunch of brains in communication. And here's what's real scary about them. They just ask for rights. They profess themselves as people. And who's to say they're not? I mean, we already sort of have transhuman intelligences in the form of corporations. It's the idea that the brain is one consciousness is not necessarily true. Maybe it's just an illusion. So, get to something actually practical. Here's the experiment I want to do. I went through this kind of fast. I'll have a lot of time for Q&A afterward or whatever. So right now, the way we study the brain is EEGs and MRIs, and these things are really crude. Imagine sticking electrodes on a processor. And then trying to ask the question, well, what web page is this processor displaying? Is it displaying Google? Is it displaying Yahoo? And sure, you can find patterns over time, but, you know, if a process is running in the background, you'll get tons of background noise. And these things sort of don't work. I mean, this idea that we can just put a electrode that's picking up thousands and thousands of neurons on your head and try to get some useful information out of it doesn't make sense in silicon. Why should it make sense in biology? But if the page uses flash, you'll know, because flash spikes your CPU to 100%, and that'll be nice and easy to detect. Inner brain communication. What protocol does the brain use? inside the brain, things are communicating. How? Right? There's neurons connecting them, but what, right, you have, if I take two computers and I connect an Ethernet wire between them, that's a protocol, and we know what protocol that is, and we can, you know, put a vampire tap on it and sniff it and figure out what the computers are saying to each other. So what's visual cortex 1 saying to visual cortex 2? If we figure out what protocol the brain uses, not only can we sniff it, but we can inject into it. And it shifts this paradigm of what brains really are. Like, you're taking information in through your eyes and then out through your motor cortex. This doesn't necessarily have to be true. It's all you need to do is be able to get raw data in and out of the brain. I mean, I already accept that I could exist, the nature of my work, I could exist in a room in front of a computer for the rest of my life and I'd be fine. I'd be able to get money, I'd be able to get food delivered to me. I can already exist as information. So, like, what really, when things like uploading become possible, why upload into a virtual world where you have eyes and arms and stuff? Why not just get data in and out of the locus of consciousness or whatever you call it? I mean, that's what makes consciousness so scary, because that's the part you really want to preserve when you get uploaded. Here's my experiment idea. Take two babies, I'm not necessarily specifying human babies, and let's put an electrode array on each one. Let's split the electrode array in half, and half of it will be receive, and half of it will be transmit. So whatever this baby does over here, you know, these neurons are firing in some pattern, and we'll mirror it over here. And we'll fire these neurons in the same pattern. And we'll do the same thing, right? We'll have some, you know, what pattern are these neurons firing in? What pattern are these neurons? You know, mirror it over here. And that's a two-way high-bandwidth link. What will brains do? I mean, current studies show that they'll probably make some use out of that information. The way hearing aids work doesn't mimic the ear at all. People who are born deaf because of, like, some defect in their eardrum, you could, not hearing aids, cochlear implants. You could stick a cochlear implant in their ear. And the way cochlear implants work is there's just like 19 arbitrary electrodes. They don't exactly map to sound. They just happen to be, through studies, the best way to get ear information into the brain. Now, I assume everyone in here can hear, and we take our hearing to be, you know, full spectrum. We take our hearing to be, well, that's what sound is, right? And we take our eyes to be, oh, well, that's what light is. But there's no particular reason that we can only hear between 20 and 20,000 hertz. There's no particular reason we can only see between 300 and 900 nanometers. That's just one part of the visual spectrum. That's just one part of the auditory spectrum. The cochlear implants, they just, you know, shove them in and it develops links to the auditory cortex. Brains are incredibly plastic. So if we could develop that two-way communication channel, I think the babies could learn to use it. And we'd get sort of, I'm not sure exactly what you see in like Siamese twins and stuff, where the brains are linked. But if we do this, and we do this electrically, we have a huge advantage. We are sniffing 100% of that channel. Once we've digitized the data, it's very easy to losslessly put it into a computer, run, you know, MATLAB stuff over it to say, ooh, well, maybe that's what the brains are saying. And then this doesn't have to all be passive. This can be active, too. You can inject frames. You can do replay attacks, right? A replay attack from computers is, you know, say I sniff an authentication session, right? I sniff you authenticating to Facebook. Then I replay this. Just send the exact same packets you sent and authenticate as you to Facebook. So say we know that the baby sent an ID of a red square. Well, I replay it and I can resend the ID of a red square. And we can build up sort of the protocol vocabulary. I mean, okay, so a protocol is, Ethernet's a protocol, and there's words in the vocabulary of the protocol. What are these words for the brain? So as far as I know, no experiment like this has ever been done before. What people seem to try to do is have this idea that, okay, we're going to put electrodes on the motor cortex, or we're going to stimulate the motor cortex, or we're going to use optogenetics on the retina. We only do this because this is close to the input and output, and we have an understanding of it. But it's not revolutionary. It's not going to lead to like new understanding. We have a pretty good idea of how the retina and the motor cortex work already. My question is, how does that information go upstream? So I looked for the actual scientific word to describe this, and I couldn't exactly find it, but there's got to be some sort of locus of consciousness somewhere in the brain. And this is like the, you know, the high seat, the throne, and everything else is, you know, putting information up and taking information down. That's what I want a high bandwidth link into. I want to be able to convey complex ideas in brain protocol. And there's even a question of, is everyone's brain protocol the same? If it's so plastic, maybe it just evolves, but, you know, maybe through simulations and prediction, we can figure out what it is and figure out how to sort of, say you want to know Kung Fu, and I, you know, it's one of my favorite scenes from The Matrix. I don't think everybody could learn Kung Fu exactly the same way. I don't think you could send the same data into different people's brains and they'd learn the same set of skills. I think you sort of have to scan the brain first, figure out, because everything in the brain is sort of a, again, this is all theory. My actual knowledge in this stuff isn't too great. I've read like Douglas Hofstadter and stuff, and this has got to be some sort of like map and a map of ideas. And we know this anecdotally, and we know this a bit in cognitive psychology. And these ideas are linked. So if you want to learn Kung Fu, you're probably going to link it to things that are already in your brain. So first, we scan the brain. We figure out what are the easiest attachment places for the Kung Fu skills required, and then send it in. So with this linking experiment, sure, two babies are linked, they grow up, maybe they can, you know, do cool telepathy things together, but what if you remove one of the babies and switch it to a computer? There's your metacortex. That's the sort of high bandwidth pipe I want in and out of my brain. I come up with ideas. I have to put them down on paper. And sure, they talk about, well, that's how you make a well-formed idea, but what does well-formed really mean? I mean, so the way I sort of think about it, and this is sort of like Ben Goetzel, OpenCog style, there are some common nodes near the inputs and near the outputs. We all have an idea of the word fish. I have an idea in our brain of this concept of a fish, and it links to other things. Maybe you were traumatized by fish as a child, and it links to trauma, or maybe you had some fish for dinner last night. But these nodes are close to the output, close to the input and close to the output. And those are sort of the same and similar people in human brains. And as you get closer to the center of the brain, the nodes get weirder, and the nodes may not express such a concrete idea. But if we could scan them and figure out what this vocabulary is, that even if it's specific to your brain, it probably doesn't change too much over time, so you could sniff it for a bit and then model it. And then figure out how to attach new nodes more directly. Figure out how to... So, Flynn effect, right? Flynn effect says IQ goes up 10 points every decade. And they renormalize the test as such. One of the reasons for this that's been hypothesized is that the amount of data available to the brain has skyrocketed, particularly recently, even since like the Renaissance, sure, since the Enlightenment. But it keeps going up. Right? If you grew up in like a small fishing village and all you did was fishing, the amount of nodes in your brain and the amount of new stuff that's coming in is sort of limited. But as this stuff gets, as information becomes more complex, our brains become more complex to match it. Then there's the question, like I was saying before, where does your brain stop? What, maybe some of these nodes don't lie in your brain anymore. Maybe, so I have a theory that people don't remember information as much anymore as where information is located, because that's easier to remember. And I know this anecdotally. You don't remember. I remember, it's Wikipedia, scroll down a page. It's right there. Why remember all the information when you can just remember a pointer to the information? I mean, pointer in kind of a compsci way. There's a question of whether these nodes exist in the brain anymore. The only thing constraining us from an intelligence explosion is bandwidth. We don't need to understand the brain even to massively augment our intelligence. All we need to do is be able to get more data in and out, and our brain will sort of do the rest. So, it's my ideas about the future. A little scary, a little psychologically unsatisfying, but, we were made through evolution, and if biological evolution isn't really working anymore, Idiocracy style, technological evolution is the next stage. Slides are up on churchofsingularity.com, or contact me, juhad@gmail. And that's it. That's my talk. Any questions? Yeah, go ahead.
So, very interesting.
I'm sure it's good.
Hello. Is that picking up now? Great. All right, so I'm glad I stumbled in here and heard this. I thought it was fantastic.
Cool.
The bandwidth, the only thing holding us back is the bandwidth. That's interesting to me because I think there is actually, I've been kind of perplexed by the idea that sometimes our brains purposely take the bandwidth or put a ceiling on that bandwidth. So, for example, obviously language is an invention, and I now use language with thought, which seems completely silly to me. So if I touch something hot, I retract my hand without even thinking. But if I'm consciously thinking about things you were just telling me, and I'm having thoughts, I have to put those thoughts into English for myself in my own head just to have those thoughts, which seems really alien to me and really strange. That why am I going through the bother of doing that? It's actually really depressing to think that you have to slow your brain is translating it to something so it can understand itself. Any thoughts or perspective on that?
Sure. So, voice is a protocol just like any other. You speak in English, and there's even a question about whether different languages have different amounts of bandwidth. People who know more languages have a larger vocabulary. You always hear, particularly if you're reading like existentialism in German, they have like Dasein. We don't really know what it is. We can't translate it. The Übermensch. It is sort of a weird idea. And think about this. When you first learn to read, when everyone first learns to read in the Western world, the way they do it is they do it phonetically. They learn, this makes this sort of sound, because they can speak before they can read. And even the idea of speaking before you can read is why? So if you grow up and you grow up reading, you eventually learn not to subvocalize when you read. You learn to just look at a word and link it right to the concept without having to go through the part of your brain that processes language. Unfortunately, there's nothing similar for writing. That's an input-only thing. Go back to my slides about bandwidth. I can read at about 1,000 words per minute. people who sub-vocalize can only read at about 200, which is what they can talk at as well. So the disparity between upstream and downstream bandwidth is the fact that you don't have to vocalize the idea. I mean, vision is just from a information theory standpoint much higher bandwidth than sound is. So yeah, you scan a page of words and those get translated right to ideas, and why do you even need the words? Yeah, you guys read Snow Crash. This idea that there's some sort of weird pattern that you can put to like make people do stuff, to literally jailbreak the brain. And it gets sort of creepy when you think about the illusion of consciousness, and maybe if you think about the wrong ideas, it'll all start to unravel. You know. Do you feel that? No. Do you feel that addressed?
No, what?
Do you feel that I got what you were saying and that addressed?
Yeah,
cool.
I think so. It's just interesting to me that obviously the brain is imposing a bandwidth on itself for some strange reason.
Yeah. Although, I mean, you're constrained by your vocal cords.
That's true.
You're constrained by the output mechanism. Once we have a better output mechanism, this is why you got to do the experiment in babies, too. If you're not constrained by your vocal cords, who knows what you'll learn to express? So, yeah, I think it's limited just because of the physical biology of the matter, nothing to do with the actual compute power of the brain.
So I'm kind of curious, why bandwidth? Why not just compress everything more instead?
Why bandwidth? Why not just compress everything more? Okay.
Why draw instead of, and why write instead of drawing, for example?
Okay, so... So yeah, drawing is sort of, it's another way to express things. So every time I use the word bandwidth, to actually say bits and bytes of bandwidth isn't that relevant. Right now, that screen is 1024 by 768, probably 24-bit color. So megabytes and megabytes are going up there every second. But clearly this bandwidth doesn't have much complexity to it because it's displaying the same thing on the screen, and I'm no good at keynotes, so my slides are pretty simple. And that can be compressed really well, just even using like a arithmetic coding. So when I say bandwidth, I refer to more the, going back to the idea of Kolmogorov complexity. How many people are familiar with that? Okay, I'll try to give a... I sort of explained it before. I'll try to give a better explanation. It's the maximum compression that's still understandable to a system. Kolmogorov complexity? I write the word. It's down there. I might be saying it wrong. I don't know. I've never heard anyone else say it. Again, you know, my idea of Kolmogorov is pronounced like that because whatever. So yes, when I refer to bandwidth, I don't mean uncompressed bandwidth. I mean already maximally compressed for the target system, right? So this comes from the web, right? When I go to Facebook.com, I send an HTTP header that says accept encodings. And one of the encodings you can accept is gzip. And gzip is a compression algorithm. So I basically negotiate with Facebook.com and say, hey, I'm a modern enough web browser. You don't have to send all the data uncompressed. You can gzip it for me. So, you know, you could extend that to bzip too. Basically, anything that your brain can understand and decompress, whatever the maximum packing is what I refer to as actual bits. You know, even so, that's what I say here in the downstream bandwidth. You can read 1,000 words per minute. Writing is inherently very uncompressed. I mean, it's uncompressed just by, you can run it through gzip and get incredible compression. So clearly it's uncompressed. There's a lot of redundancy. I mean, just the fact that you can do a frequency analysis on the English language and some letters are more frequent than others, you can throw that in a Huffman code and get increased... You can compress it more, pretty trivially. So yes, every time I refer to bandwidth, I refer to maximally compressed bandwidth already. But then again, we don't know anything about the consciousness-less eye protocol, so to say what's maximally compressed requires some experimentation.
Awesome. It's just a quick thought. Just a quick question. What are your thoughts around empathy? Empathy.
Like the idea of mirror neurons. Mirror neurons are pretty well understood. If you watch a video of some guy snowboarding and you see him, you know, stick his back foot out, the neurons in your motor cortex to do that fire, but they fire at a sub-muscle activating level. And this is sort of how your brain learns, by mirroring in its head what it sees. So empathy is sort of, I view the brain itself sort of as a compression and decompression algorithm. Right? You see, and your eyes are ridiculously good cameras. In 2008, I worked on Google Street View. I built a camera that's on the Street View cars now. And those cameras were pretty good. 5 megapixels, 15 frames per second. The lens was pretty small. It's nothing compared to the eye. The eye is about 75 megapixels with a super tiny lens that can actually resolve it all. A ridiculous dynamic range. In fact, our dynamic range is so ridiculous that we can see outside in bright sunlight and we can see individual photons. Before they had photon detectors, they would use, it turns out Asian women were the best at this, they would put them in a dark room for a while and then ask them if they saw the photon or not. And they could detect individual photon events. Ridiculous dynamic range. Where was I? Eyes coming back to empathy. What did he say? Oh, yeah, okay. Empathy is... Well, how did I go off on that tangent? brain is a compression and decompression algorithm. Eyes are ridiculously high bandwidth, and clearly they're compressed down when you remember things. You probably, you know, now that I say this, you might remember. You wouldn't remember probably what color shirt I had on in an hour, because your brain compressed that away. Your brain abstracts at the higher level. I mean, abstraction is sort of one of the keys to intelligence. But so coming back, so you compress things down, you store them, and you decompress things. Empathy arises because people's compression and decompression algorithms are pretty similar. And ideas conveyed, like I said, boundaries of brains aren't so rigid. You can sort of share that idea. 90% of communication is unconscious in person. I just made that statistic up, but I read something like it probably. So through unconscious communication, you convey your feelings and the mirror neurons activate and you start feeling the same thing. You walk into a room full of sad people, you start feeling sad because the same neurons that are firing in them start firing in you. This is the same way you learn things, and this is... Empathy is apparently a useful trait. Well, we'll see if psychopaths inherit the earth. Then it turns out it wasn't really useful. But so yeah, it's this idea of the compression and decompression algorithms in different people are similar, right? We can pretty universally in the human condition describe some things as good and some things as bad, and because of those universals, we have empathy. Although I know very little cognitive psychology, so. So that's questionable. the bandwidth limitations, are they on the conscious or the unconscious? So these are all very bad. Why is this doing this?
It sounds like the voice.
These are all very unrigid numbers. These are all very... Very fluid numbers. I sort of made them up, but I showed you where I made them up from. So, is there a lot more communication going on at the unconscious level? I mean, so think about it. When people like go to learn kung fu the non-matrixy way, they go to a kung fu trainer. And they can probably learn kung fu like that better than they can learn it from a book. So there probably is a higher bandwidth communication channel between you and the kung fu trainer, because you know, I would think that there's a lot more unconscious communication there than your book is pretty conscious. Reading is a pretty conscious process. So yeah, I'm sure there's unconscious bandwidth too, but I don't think it's on the order of megabits or even kilobits. I think it's still pretty close to this. Again, yeah, all this stuff about bandwidth really relates to the idea of Kolmogorov complexity and maximum compression. You ever, you know, sometimes you'll read a 300-page book on a topic and be like, I don't really get that topic at all. Then you read a one-page paper and you're like, wow, this is pretty good. And that's why, like, revered papers in science are structured DNA one page. I think there's tons of... I mean, unconscious, basically, coming back to the idea of nodes of the brain, some of those nodes are conscious nodes and some of those nodes are unconscious nodes. Maybe the distinction between implicit and explicit memory or... But yeah, so there is a lot more unconscious communication too, but you're still constrained by the raw pipe.
By the what?
By the raw pipe. There's no way that you can get more bandwidth in between two people than what the mediums connecting us can convey, right? So the fact that I'm looking at you actually helps convey some more information too. Yeah, but not. There's no way to get more bandwidth through than just what I can see and hear. Now, if there were a metacortex connecting us through the internet, then we could connect with more bandwidth. And even, you know, the visual bandwidth. So you got to think, okay, vision, again, you're 60 hertz maybe. That's sort of a weird thing to say about the human eye, persistence of vision and everything. But let's even say 60 hertz, 75 megapixels. That is tons and tons and tons of megabits. But again, Kolmogorov complexity. You have to compress this. I'm looking at you. You're not moving very much. You're not rapidly changing shape every, you know, you're... The amount of information you're conveying visually, I would say, is on the order of bits per second. The amount of auditory information is also on the order of bits per second. Nothing on the orders of what we're used to on the internet. So where do I think that lies? You had a question? Yeah, sure. Oops, sorry.
Okay. So... My question's kind of simple. I'm just wondering, you know how they say you only tap into 10% of your brain? That's something I've heard
Sure. For
a long time. So based on your theory or hypothesis, if this were to happen, would you be essentially just more effectively using that same 10%, or would you be opening up to the theorized untapped 90%?
So let's talk about that 10% thing. That is a true statistic, but people misinterpret it very often. All it says is that about 10% of your brain is active at any given time. It doesn't mean that the other 90% sits inactive. That makes no sense from a biological standpoint. If it really sat inactive, it would have evolved out, right? Things with smaller heads and smaller brains and brains that use less power... with the same amount of intelligence or more fit. All that says is that only 10% of your neurons are firing at any given time. You do not want 100% of your neurons to fire. That's a seizure. That's what happens during seizure. All your neurons start blinking. It's not always the same 10%, no. And this, I mean, in CPUs, it's the same way. If you're in, so I got a Pentium chip in here, Core i7. If I fire off a multiply instruction to it, the divider is sitting idle. The divider, right? The Pentium chip has a hardware multiplier and a hardware divider. If I fire off a multiply instruction, the divider is sitting idle. They do things in CPUs to try to be clever about this and say, ooh, is there a divide coming up soon? Okay, we'll put that on the divider. But yeah, CPUs, at least older ones, only 10% are active at any given time as well. 100% activity in a CPU is is nothing. The fact that only 10% of your neurons are firing is information. The set of 10% conveys a lot more information than the set of 100%, right? There's only one set of 100%. That's seizing. There's only one set of 0%. That's being dead. But 10%, there's a lot of different sets of 10%. That's information. Anything else? Got like 8 more minutes. I could talk more about me. I could end the slideshow now. I could.
Tell us a little bit more about your background.
So I'm. In 2007, I was the first guy in the world to unlock the iPhone, to get the iPhone working on other carriers. Since then, I got really good at reverse engineering. I do phone unlocks, for example. One of my recent projects was a BMW car ECU. People want to figure out how to chip the car ECU, how to put a new engine map onto it so you can get more power out of the car. So I reverse engineered the protocols that BMW uses to update the engine map. And again, this is stuff made by man being reversed by man. And that gives me a huge advantage, again, from a cognitive complexity standpoint. Look, I'm an engineer too. I've worked at Google, I've worked at Facebook, software engineer, sort of did electrical stuff before that, won the science fair for a 3D display I built, mechanical engineer before that, used to do battle bots. But because I have this engineering background, my compression and decompression algorithm is similar to the guy who built that ECU. So I can sort of think how he thinks, get in his headspace, and reverse engineer it. So yeah, I come from reverse engineering background, and time to tackle bigger challenges. Yeah. If you're reverse engineering something somebody's already built, someone already has the answer. It's sort of useless in the grand scheme of things. I've been sort of traumatized with the idea of like singularity and stuff my whole life. It's a scary notion that, I mean, whether you believe in it or not, it is sort of a religious impulse. It's sort of, I could search churchofsingularity.com, this sort of rapture techno-utopia. You know, they say it's they say it's the rapture for IQ 150 people. We sort of have to do it. It's sort of inevitable. Evolution doesn't stop. Stagnation is death. So that's my background. This is the stuff I want to actually start working on from a more grounded in science perspective. This talk was sort of theoretical and fun. I've spoken before on, I give very boring, very technical talks on reverse engineering. I can talk about like, one of my favorite things to do is there's boot ROMs in all these different chips. And the boot ROM is the little bit of code. It's the first code that runs when you turn a chip on. And I love dumping these boot ROMs, figuring out what's in the boot ROM, and figuring out all their cute little protection schemes that they put on them. And I give very boring, very dry technical talks on that. So this was more of a, I'm just going to talk about something I'm thinking about. Thanks. Yeah. So, you know, it's, I'm going to try to write this stuff up more formally. I do actually want to do the baby experiment in mice. No, I'm single. Oh, I'm single. You could actually probably get this done in like a third world country, but you know, I wouldn't. Even if consciousness is an illusion, to mess with people's consciousness like that, I feel is, I'm sure it's fun, but, you know, babies can't really consent. Try the experiment in mice, try the experiment in monkeys, although it would be really cool to do in humans because they can talk about it. They can. Well, we'll see what'll happen. But you know, one of the things I'm Like I said, I was the first person to unlock the iPhone, and to this day I'm still impressed that I was the one who did it. There's a lot of people who are very talented in reverse engineering, but more traditionally, people thought, you know, okay, the same way people are trying to reverse the brain now. There's a project called the IBM Blue Brain Project, which they are literally finding out how each neuron is connected to each other neuron and going to simulate that in a supercomputer. IBM loves their supercomputers. They play Jeopardy with them and play chess with them. And Blue Brain Project is another one of these. There's a new IBM project called Synapse, which is going to try to emulate a whole human brain by 2020. But this is very static and traditional. Static reverse engineering, for me, is nowhere near as productive as dynamic reverse engineering. Don't reverse engineer. I don't want you to like hand me a system and tell me to reverse this. I want to reverse it in the context that it's being used. So that's why I like this brain experiment. We don't need to study the protocol. We don't even need to know what the protocol is. And maybe even by trying to study it and trying to know what it is, we're influencing it. It's Heisenberg uncertainty principle-ish. So to do this experiment and just let the babies develop a protocol naturally, you get more at the heart of what's going on in the brain than saying, okay, we're going to grow these neurons in a petri dish and we're going to hook them up to a flight simulator. All right, we just influence what they did. It doesn't say anything about what the protocol used in brains is.
Would you ever be afraid that you're going to accidentally break
your own brain? Oh, yeah. I told you, it might not even take hardware. It might just take software. If I knew the right words to utter right now... Oops. Scary ideas. To the what? Brick the brain. Did you try to tamper with it? Oh, you're done. You're done. You don't get a new one. All right.
Thank you.
Cool. Anything else? Last minute? So I'm George. You can find me on the internet. I have a Wikipedia page which talks about the more traditional stuff I've done. This is the new stuff I'm sort of branching up into. You guys got the sneak preview, if anything comes of it. You guys saw it first.